Welcome to Sibylline Podcasts, part of our World Risk Register Threat Monitoring Service. These podcasts are released on a weekly basis, covering timely and relevant topics. In these discussions, we hope to shed light on evolving scenarios and provide actionable predictions and implications. We hope you enjoy listening and welcome any feedback. Hello and welcome to our latest podcast. This time we're going to be talking about Russia, notably following President Putin's State of the Nation address this morning, which we thought gave us a good opportunity for us to give our own assessment of the state of Russia and also looking at Russia's broader ambitions internationally, which of course is one of our top 10 global themes for 2018. With me today, I'm glad to have Ed Johnson, who is our lead Eurasia analyst. So, Ed, what is the state of Russia at the moment, and what are the key issues at play at the moment?
Hi there, Pete. Yes, a very good question indeed. I think firstly, the thing to address is the upcoming presidential election, which is taking place on the 18th of March. This is very much an exercise in re-legitimizing President Putin's rule as he enters a fourth term. He's highly likely, he will win the election. The other challengers are sort of very marginalized in the media or complicit with his sort of re-election in this sort of system of controlling the electoral field. So no real competition, an exercise in re-legitimizing his rule. And this in itself poses some problems. Namely, within the elite itself, moving forward into what is constitutionally supposed to be his final term, and already having sort of swapped with Prime Minister Medvedev in 2008, it's unlikely he'll repeat that. So this then opens up the question of what's next down the line in sort of 2020, 2021, when Putin's rule is 2-3 years away from ending, formally at least. What does that do in terms of elite competition? So this election is very much sending a message both to the populace and to the elite that Putin, you know, for the medium term is in charge and is still the sort of singular ruler, I would say. The second sort of state of Russia's nation that I think needs to be addressed is that of their economy, which, you know, whilst growth has recovered from sort of recession in 2014 and 2015, it's forecast to be rather anemic, not hitting much more than 2.5%, 2%. The economy itself is structurally, you know, hugely dependent on the sale of oil and gas. Obviously, at the moment, oil prices are sort of checked and not sort of back in the level that they were in the early 2000s, which boosted Russia's economy enormously. This has drained the sovereign, much vaunted sovereign wealth fund, which I think stood at around 100 billion in 2014 and is now, it's empty. They've had to sort of dip into the pension wealth fund, which they have. So again, some kind of very systemic problems with it. This was notably underscored last year by the fact that the Central Bank of Russia had to bail out three of Russia's top 10 lenders. The financial sector is very sort of weak and unstable. Lots of small regional banks, which don't offer much sort of strength to the overall system. So we're going to see this sort of pose more and more of a problem, coupled with increased social spending promises that Putin's made during this election campaign. As to the extent that they'll be implemented, you know, that's questionable given that they were sort of election time promises. But perhaps the biggest impact on Russia's economic outlook will remain the question of sanctions.
Let's dig into that in a little bit more detail. So sanctions, tensions with the West. How is this manifesting at the moment? How do you see this continuing going forward?
Well, I think the tensions, Russia's tensions with the West are going to continue. And with that, we will see the sort of the sanctions being maintained, if not expanded. The US Treasury is publish a list in late January of those sort of closest to President Putin, and it's quite likely that further measures will be imposed against those individuals and their commercial entities as the US sort of tries to seek to put pressure on Putin. This in itself will drive tensions further. There are many areas that we'll probably come on to discuss in which there's sort of scope for these tensions to remain in place, but sanctions is definitely one that the Russian government deeply resents and sort of is beginning to understand the economic impact of having capital restrictions, of business activities being limited by these individuals, very wealthy individuals controlling significant companies within the Russian economy. This was actually highlighted perhaps best yesterday, on the 28th of February, when Exxon ended its five-year cooperation agreement with Rosneft, which at the time was one of the largest deals ever concluded, up to $500 billion worth of exploration, funds for exploration of Arctic fields that have been sort of discovered through the use of new technologies and that sort of thing. And it's perhaps indicative of the deterioration in potential and realized commercial activity and cooperation between Western and Russian businesses. Obviously, ExxonMobil and Rosneft are two of the larger larger companies, but certainly these tensions and the sanctions are really are beginning to really inhibit entry into Russian markets and cooperation agreements between Western and Russian businesses.
Yeah, and just affecting the business environment in general, I guess. I suppose one of the other factors that you've alluded to there is that I think the Kremlin fundamentally feels disappointed with successive US presidents, successive US administrations, who I think Moscow had huge hopes for originally, but now they've just seem to be disregarded by Washington as before. And aside from the sanctions, we've got U.S. shale oil producers providing a counterweight to OPEC and other oil producers, so that if the price of oil reaches more than $50 per barrel, then U.S. shale producers increase their activity, which brings the price back down again. So I think that is also a source of resentment for Russian producers. Do you think that's fair enough to say?
No, absolutely, and I think that's prompted their recent cooperation with OPEC, and this is a trend we expect to continue, because for both of those parties, Russia and the OPEC countries, there is a desire to maintain profitability with oil prices, and from Russia's perspective, having a more stabilized, consolidated price of oil is actually more efficient for them rather than sort of this boom and bust system, and if having the opportunity to control supply as well, I think it's a very crucial aspect for them. And obviously, Rosneft is the world's largest single oil producer. They have a significant stake in ensuring that this company is run effectively and sort of profitably, as it were.
I think it'd be remiss of us not to touch on Syria in terms of talking about tensions with the West and so on. And of course, Russian activity in Syria is part of Russia's ongoing policy of opportunistic foreign policy to try and undermine the West, part of the foreign tensions or the tensions with the West and so on. So, and I think this has been quite well exemplified with the breakdown of the ceasefire in East Ghouta in Syria today and yesterday by Syrian government forces, which are supposed to be allied with, or which are allied with Russian forces. The US, or several US officials, took the opportunity around this development to criticize Russia as not keeping the Syrian government on track. There's also evidence of from a UN report of North Korean scientists helping Syrian chemical weapon facilities to produce chemical weapons, and of course Russia is is supposed to be holding the Syrians account and making sure that they uphold international norms, international bans on chemical weapons, and US officials again criticizing Russia for their inability to do that. So, you know, it's a two-way street. If between Russia and the US, you know, they're both taking every opportunity they can to take a pop at each other, and that really, I think, is symptomatic of tensions with the West. I'd like to move on to predictions and implications. Before I do you have any further comments on that, Ed, or should we move on?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. A couple of points you made there about Syria. From the Russian perspective, that, you know, whilst Putin declared in December last year that, you know, sort of mission accomplished during a surprise visit to Syria, Russia will maintain its sort of support for the Assad regime, both from a tactical point of view, its operational point of view. Sorry, it's quite a low cost affair. And that gives the Russians opportunity to test new equipment and new procedures and that sort of thing. But above all, I think it's important that Russia for itself remains a stakeholder in that conflict, in the resolution of it, much similar to Ukraine. It will try and sort of leverage its involvement as this opportunistic kind of action that initially got it into the conflict to ensure that Russia is at the top table when ultimately there is a sort of peace agreement that's made, that Russian interests are protected, notably in Syria. You've got the naval base and the airport and the airfield. And this is a sort of trend that we're going to see more and more of, is Russia inserting itself into situations in order to allow it a future position down the line where it is considered alongside, or it has to work with, the West in terms of resolving different conflicts globally. And this could lead to this sort of compartmentalization of the West's dealings with Russia, in that on the one hand, it maintains the sanctions and maintains pressure over the issue of Crimea, which began it all in 2014, but actually is forced to deal with Russia in other areas and improve some areas of relations and ties. Almost a similar way to which the West dealt with the Soviet Union back in during the Cold War, diametrically opposed in other areas, but in some, there's some limited form of cooperation.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's look forward then. How much has the upcoming election at the end of this month been an all-encompassing focal point for the Kremlin? You know, it seems that a lot of the domestic policies, a lot of the foreign policies of the last couple of months have been geared towards providing as favourable as possible a context for those elections to take place in, such as I think there's been an increase in the minimum wage and so on and so forth. Is it fair to say that the elections have been taking up most of the bandwidth of the Kremlin for the last couple of months? And does that mean that after the elections we're going to see a rebalancing and an increase in Russian activity in other areas, and what do you think those areas might be?
Yes, I think the Kremlin, you know, obviously for elections for any incumbent are a source of sort of great instability or challenge to overcome, and even in a system as tightly controlled as the one headed by President Putin, the elections take a certain amount of organizing. As I said in the beginning, it's all about sort of expectations and setting and controlling the process. And that requires compliant opposition candidates. It requires money above all. And that's been largely successfully done. Putin is genuinely popular. There's no one can reasonably deny that. The sort of strategy of getting 70% turnout is probably much harder than the other part of that, which is a 70% vote for Putin. There's been a sort of pretty targeted and, dare I use the phrase, hip approach to getting younger voters in particular out to vote and encouraging people to not sort of just abstain because it's the result of foregone conclusion, playing up on the sort of lots of culture and identity values that Russia that have evolved in Russia over the last 6 years. So I think moving forward after the election, you're going to see perhaps a point of consolidation rather than a kind of radical shift. I would anticipate that Prime Minister Medvedev will remain in place. He's a sort of good placeholder, for the office of the Prime Minister. So he represents a kind of, while a weakened figure, it's almost more helpful having him there than bringing in somebody else who sort of gives a perception of being more promoted or that sort of thing. We'll see some gentle reshuffles, but perhaps nothing kind of, no systemic overhaul. You will have further kind of consolidation of power by the security services, these infamous Yarovaya laws, which are sort of aimed at combating online terrorism and require all internet service providers to store their data and servers in Russia. That comes online in May 2018, if I'm correct. So these sorts of things will sort of allow the system to regroup effectively after the elections, and it will be, broadly speaking, a kind of domestic and international policy continuity rather than any significant change, I'd say.
And so Putin's popularity domestically, is that intrinsically linked to Russian adventurism abroad and Russia being seen as a international power and solving or helping to resolve the civil war in Syria and the civil war in Libya and so on and so forth? Is that a fundamental source of domestic support, and therefore are we going to see an increase or at least a continuity of those policies?
Again, a very good question. I think yes to a large extent, yes. I think Putin has a lot of credit in the bank for it's 18 years he's been sort of running the show in one form or another. A lot of credibility for stabilizing Russia in the early 2000s, instigating the boom years in the mid 2000s before the recession in 2008. And I think his return to the Kremlin in 2012 is a very marked turning point. At that point, he did become more conservative, defending Russian values vis-a-vis the West, juxtaposing Russia very effectively in the minds of Russians to liberal Western values. You had sort of saw the very public and pronounced sort of re-engagement of the Orthodox Church with society, the kind of anti-gay laws and messages and sort of stance that Russia has come to espouse. And yes, ultimately the 2014 sort of annexation of Crimea was symbol to many Russians, a sort of resurgence and instilled a sense of pride that had perhaps been lacking since the collapse of the Soviet Union. As to whether these sorts of adventures in Syria and Libya continue, I mean, they can. They're relatively low cost, and Russia's showed its sort of tactical adeptness. But as Crimea showed, whilst you might have that tactical adeptness, the strategic awareness and astuteness to understand the consequences of these actions long term, perhaps that's still not as developed as the ability to actually do it. And project their power not just in their own region, but for the first time also in the Arab world, which is a significant point.
Yeah, so you mentioned low-cost measures there, and given the troubles in the Russian economy that we talked about earlier, do you think that there's going to be a shift in Russian foreign policy from quite expensive foreign interventionism with large forces, air power, ground forces, and so on and so forth, to cheaper option or to the primacy of cheaper options such as cyber or private military companies, so deniability and not so as expensive for the state?
Absolutely. This sort of evolution of conflict is, we've seen it in Ukraine, where Wagner, the private military company I assume you're alluding to, was first sort of operational. And this will continue. There's no doubt that the crucial word is the plausible deniability. As an economic agent, they are effective. That was the reason that they were killed in this operation by US forces a few weeks ago. They were attempting to take an oil field. And there's an understanding that Wagner receives 25% of all the profits of the oil fields it captures and is controlled and sort of backed by a personal friend of Putin. It's all kind of linked in together, and yes, we will see this evolution. You have more and more sort of cyber attacks. Perhaps in Ukraine, you saw them pivot towards sort of targeted assassinations and destabilizing means through another way. Only two three days ago, the Polish security agencies arrested three members of a group that was affiliated with the Kremlin's program and are on suspicion of burning down a Hungarian cultural center in Western Ukraine. And that's significant because Ukraine and Hungary are having a sort of ongoing disagreement and a sort of spat, really, about the rights of about 150,000 ethnic Hungarians who live in that region in Zakarpattia in Western Ukraine. So Russia's, you know, identifying these sort of little points of weakness or where it can, you know, very, very easily just cause much bigger problems for a very low cost or risk. And, you know, you go back to what happened in Montenegro with the sort of attempted coup there. You know, this sort of operational and tactical flexibility is quite, it serves them very well. And I think, you know, they realize that the benefit more often than not outweighs the cost. Mm. So I think we've seen more of that, going forward.
Yeah. So let's look, let's turn back to Russia domestically and look a little bit further into the future if we can. So we've got, it looks like we're going to have a Putin presidency out to 2024. You mentioned at the beginning questions around succession. How do you see that evolving what do you think will happen next? And as we draw towards 2024, what do you think are the kind of issues that we'll see associated with succession?
Wow. I mean, without having the crystal ball, it's very difficult to say, but it's quite clear that the sort of thinking is nobody will blink or do anything until up to and past the 2020 Duma elections. That would be sort of 4 years to go still of Putin's final term. But I think the aim is, with a system that Putin created, it's all about stability. It's all about understanding where things are going. So this is a huge point of potential conflict and a source of instability, because, you know, there are tensions within the elite. The arrest and trial of former economics minister Alexei Ulyakayev last year over sort of accepting a bribe from the head of Rosneft, Igor Sechin, is indicative of that. They're in two competing blocks within the government, within the elite. Sechin representing of the sort of Siloviki or more statist approach, have it like these big state-owned companies like Rosneft or Rostec, whereas Ulyakayev represented a sort of more technocratic, good governance, good business practices, or perhaps not that much, after being found accepting a $2 million bribe, allegedly. So we see that kind of tension will continue within the government, and it will sort of begin to shape out. We can't really tell too much, but it's going to be a source of tension moving forward as to how these two blocks and the sort of myriad of different factions within the elite all begin to interact as everybody begins to accept that Putin's role will change. Whether he sort of how he leaves power will almost define what's next. There's been talk of perhaps setting up a constitutional or making him the head of the constitutional courts, of giving him an Ayatollah kind of role. This will emerge, and how that does and the shape of these sorts of things will inform the sort of future developments, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. One final question, really. In terms of, we talked about the issues in the economy and the trajectory of the economy. With Putin coming potentially towards the end of his direct rule in 2024, do you think that he will be handing over a failing economy? You know, is sort of economic collapse inevitable, and how will that manifest? And is sort of looking at 2024 a focal point for that, or do you think that economic collapse isn't inevitable and actually, you know, we don't need to worry about it?
Wow.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Another difficult question.
I think perhaps a way of understanding that might be better to sort of flip it on its head and say, within 2012, would we have said that Russia would have invaded Ukraine and annexed part of its territory? Would we say that the relations between the West and Russia would be at the worst since the height of the Cold War? So it's very difficult to tell. I think we can look at some indicators and see where, you know, that might suggest as to what would be the future in terms of Russia's economy, its relationship with the West, and sort of business, overall business environment. I think, you know, a change in prime minister and the installation of one of the sort of statist bloc as head of prime minister, that would be a kind of indication that, you know, they're in it for the sort of longer term, and, you know, whatever the cost to the economy, the confrontation with the West and the current state of affairs is more essential to their ongoing rule and the narrative that they can create around that. I think, you know, it'd be interesting to watch, as I mentioned earlier, the finance sector quite carefully, how that plays out. But essentially, you know, the limitations of cooperation with Western businesses, the lack of access to Western capital, you know, if that prompts Russia to kind of seek closer economic ties with other economies in the world and improve access to their markets, you know, this essentially we can't sort of see the individual events and outcomes that will shape it ultimately, but we can see kind of these broader trends emerging that if Russia sort of starts pivoting away from seeking cooperation with the West or seeking to attract Western business or work with them, you know, these would be the kind of points to suggest that, you know, they're seeking to avoid economic kind of doom and gloom. But the main issue would probably be, from my point, as unless systemic reform is implemented, it's unlikely that Russia's business model, as it were, can kind of cope with the rather cope or can't sort of grow out of the challenges that it's facing now or evolve out of it. You know, a rise in the price of oil would obviously be beneficial for them, but they can't. You know, they there's very little they can do, or, you know, a limited extent that they can do to control that.
Yeah. So, just I said final question, but perhaps just to wrap up and conclude, we're looking potentially at some shifting alliances internationally from Russia's side in order to try and boost the economy, you know, perhaps, and that's the beginnings of that have been seen with a potential OPEC deal with non-OPEC oil producers, notably Russia, which is bringing Saudi Arabia and Russia closer together for the first time, really. So that might be an interesting one to watch in terms of redefining the dynamics of parts of the Middle East and how that evolves. Russia and China, as China's economy continues to grow, do you have any comments on that before we sort of finally wrap up?
Yes, I think it's closer cooperation with Saudi is definitely something to watch. It's interesting, you know, given what's going on in Syria at the moment, and obviously that's a podcast or three in of its own right. You know, Russia's relationship with Iran, how does it balance that with, you know, a sort of its emerging relationship with Saudi Arabia? That's certainly a crucial consideration, that I think a cooperation between Russia and OPEC can serve to prop up the keep oil prices where they need to be for both countries' sort of strategic outlook moving forward. In regards to relations with China, I think it's always really important to stress that on the whole, Russia needs China and its sort of money and market more than China needs Russia. Whilst Russia, you know, particularly in Central Asia, provides a security guarantee for whereas China kind of operates on a soft power and economic investment level, you know, the prime example of this would be the nature of their relationship and how I think it will progress is in 2014 when relations with the West were sort of in free fall, deteriorating. Gazprom was very quickly concluded, I think, a deal that had been in the works for about 10 years with China to provide them with gas. Now, you know, that was probably likely driven by Russia's need to conclude a deal for a new market in gas rather than China's sudden sort of desire to conclude it. So I think that would be, that's probably going to characterize it much more than anything. China is a much more economically powerful and advanced country than Russia. So I think that is certainly going to change and evolve, and what Russia can get out of it, that remains to be seen. But I think as one of those sort of crucial regional ties, notably in Central Asia, both countries have a desire to see that region stabilized and sort of not subject to evolving militant threat or jihadist activity there, or government instability and that sort of thing. They're both interested in making sure that it's controlled and stabilized.
Brilliant. Ed, thank you very much for all of your insights there. That's fascinating and hugely useful, so thank you. If any of our comments here have provoked thoughts or what requirement for further information, then please do get in touch with us. We'd be more than happy to have one-on-one chats or supply you with various written reports that we've got that cover some of the topics that we've touched on here in greater detail. In the meantime, thank you very much, and we look forward to speaking to you soon. Thank you for listening, and we hope you have found this podcast useful. If you would like to learn more about our services, or if you have any questions or feedback, please get in touch at info@sibylline.co.uk.